The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The New York Times, Teen Inc., and The Teen Magazine. The first article is from The New York Times, and it's titled, Sidney Poitier Was the Star We Desperately Needed Him to Be. Without the obstacles put in his way, he could have been even bigger than he was, but Mr. Poitier still managed to be a giant, which in itself is astonishing. This is by Wesley Morris and was published January 7th, 2022. Were anyone to ask me who's the greatest American movie star, my answer would never change. And it would never change because the answer is easy. The greatest American movie star is Sidney Poitier. You mean the greatest black movie star? I don't. Am I being controversial? Confrontational? Contrarian? No. I'm simply telling the truth. Who did more with less? Of whom was less expected as much as more? Who had more eyes and more daggers, more hopes and fears and intentions aimed his way, at his person, his skill, and by extension, his people? Race shouldn't matter here, but it must, since Hollywood made his race the matter. Movie after movie insisted he be the black man for white America, which he was fine with, of course. He was black. But the radical shock of Sidney Poitier was the stress his stardom placed on the man, the human. Let's say Sidney Poitier had a good 20-year run as a star, from 1958, when The Defiant Ones came out, to 1978, when the last of his hit trilogy with Bill Cosby left movie theaters. He was making just about a movie a year, many of them unmemorable. On one hand, that's stardom. On the other, Sidney Poitier achieved his greatness partially as a matter of despite. He achieved all he did despite knowing what he couldn't do. I mean, he could have done it. He could have played Cool Hand Luke, could have been The Graduate, could have done Bullet, could have been Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. There are maybe a dozen roles, capstones, that nobody would have offered to Mr. Poitier because he wouldn't have been right for the part. I believe with all my heart that Mr. Poitier was as crucial in the odyssey of freedom and equality for black Americans, for personhood, as Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, as Martin Luther King Jr. A clear descendant of Douglass's rhetorical brilliance, he spoke the words of white people, but from his own mouth. He projected image bigot, what is now a galaxy of other black actors, doing acting as diverse and tiered as a shopping mall. Black actors in this country bear the curious, hilarious burden of history. Their work has to be advanced, to answer, to question, sit with, and not know, to take on, to risk, to do not only more, but often the most. It must also counteract and dispel. It must undo. Mr. Poitier was American art's great undoer. In the movies, black characters were jolly statuary, hoisting luggage, serving food, tending children, meant to decorate a white American's dream. Acting could be a clerical affair. Mr. Poitier arrived at the start of the civil rights movement in time to spring the black image from the prison of the antebellum and minstrelsy era. He was scarcely the first to try. He just led more people farther down the road than any other artist. Of course, what ensued instead was complicated, a kind of prisoner swap. This undoing business is tricky. The undoer must be both historic and a vessel of history. So Mr. Poitier was accused of being all kinds of Uncle Tom, and because the task of undoing was tended to require collaboration with white people. It's what they did or what was carried out in their name that needs to be undone. The Collaborative Act opened all parties to the opprobrium of their respective people. On September 10th, 1967, at Mr. Poitier's apogee, this newspaper ran a scathing piece by Clifford Mason that asked, "Why does white America love Poitier so?" Mr. Poitier's very best friend was Harry Belafonte. Even he had his concerns. "Sidney radiated a true saintly calm and dignity," Mr. Belafonte wrote in his memoir, My Song. "I didn't want to tone down my sexuality either. Sidney did that in every role he took. I don't want to put the full rap on race. Sidney is a wonderful actor, and he mesmerized the audiences with all his performances. But he knows all as well as I do that these nuances were fundamental to his success. That saintliness was the exquisitely bitter joke of John Guare's 6 degrees of separation. That a sure way for a con man to enter the hearts and homes of Manhattan's white elite was to pose as the preppy son of Mr. Poitier, the father of 6 daughters. Mr. Poitier's gallery of highly educated, gleamingly polished, seductively agreeable characters had to be fit for entrance into white people's homes, but also attractive to black people, who would be worried that he might think himself too good for dinner at their tables. That was as much a conundrum in 1958 as it was, say, half a century later, when the country conducted an experiment to discover this measurement of blackness appropriate for a president. Like Barack Obama, Mr. Poitier was punctual culturally. He became the star he did because he was the star we desperately needed him to be. And even then, he couldn't please us all. One is left to imagine how much greater the greatest could have been. No romances, none where the woman wasn't literally blind, as she was in A Patch of Blue, none in which the trouble wasn't the romance itself, where the romance wasn't in trouble because of the fact of him. Nothing in Audrey Hepburn or Grace Kelly, Marilyn Monroe or Doris Day. Nobody dared use him in a love story to make earlier stars of Cicely Tyson or Ruby Dee, or a bigger one of Diane Carroll, the love of his off-screen life. The movie romance he and Miss Carroll did have in Paris Blues from 1961 was a timeshare with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. Mr. Poitier was denied opportunities he'll never be able to prove he was denied. We can reasonably deduce, however, that he could have been bigger than he was. But he also managed to be as big as he became, which, in itself, is a wow. He had the best 1967 and 68 of anybody. 3 box office smashes, 2 Sir with Love, In the Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, 2 of them competing Best Picture Oscar nominees, which were Heat of the Night 1, and Oscars for 2 of his co-stars. Years ago, when the movies were basically still the country's dominant art form, the American Film Institute released a countdown of the greatest stars of all time who made their debut before or in 1950. Number 1 in the male category was not Sidney Poitier, who arrived right as the list's deadline. That was Humphrey Bogart. He wasn't even number 10, which was Charlie Chaplin. Nope. The great American movie star was down at number 22, just ahead of Robert Mitchum and behind three of the Marx Brothers. But let's apply some cynical pressure here. What do the people who got Poitier to number 22 on that greatest actors list believe warranted his being even that high? There were 49 other people on it, evenly split between women and men. He's the only non-white person. Even now, I suspect Mr. Poitier's legacy really has been reduced to his firstness. And that's not nothing. That's not nothing either. He was summoned to symbolize Black America single-handedly to receive his white peers' congratulations when they make him the first Black man to accept their Oscar for being a church for German nuns in Lilies of the Field. And so the milestone is the achievement. Mr. Poitier's firstness is what puts him at the tippy top of all the home pages and front pages of the day he dies. But what does he leave? Well, that's what makes him the greatest. Like every significant star before him, Clark Gable, Betty Davis, John Wayne, Humphrey Bogart, Mae West, Poitier made being in a movie look like The Manner Born. His least inspired line readings retain a spark of passion. Each word, words that could sometimes constitute the dredge of the English language, the agonies, the torments, the humiliations, all these are the natural elements of which the key is forged, spake Mr. Poitier, as the mix-up enslaved insurrectionist Rao Ru in 1957's unspeakable Band of Angels. They all seem to have originated in his head. His most daring work turned out to be a sustained performance of himself. I know, this is a star's only job. But Sidney Poitier's was a self he forged, sculpted, and redefined. A self that, though it bore only the perfume of an island upbringing, carried a note of exotic mystery. Even when they dressed him like an outer-spaced pimp in The Long Ships, he was no mere persona of a movie Negro. Like the ancestral characters who made him necessary and the carload of badasses who thrived in his wake, the Sweetbacks, Shafts, and Priests, the Hammers and Dolomites. Nobody had experienced anybody like him before. Just listen to the meter of his lilt, the melody of it. When he spoke, you heard a symphony. His placelessness gave him the same adventurous allure and other placeless stars. The acting he did required every inch of his long body for exuberance, rapture, caution, solemnity, and rage. In no conventional sense has a Sidney Poitier character ever danced with any success. When he cuts a rug, you should keep a tourniquet handy. Yet all of his characters proceed with grace and poise. Some of that is training. He was our most famous Black method actor. The rest is simply him. The clenched fists and mid-promenade pivots, the column hugging and thrown open arms, it was all his own ballet. These were signature moves, a star making exclamatory punctuation of his being, carrying himself in cursive. The signature of what this country has always sworn it aspires to be. The next article is titled, Amongst Strangers, I Found Myself. This is from Teen Inc., published January 14th, 2019. And this is by Anonymous Morgan. I'm the product of an affair. Technically, my mother never knew it was an affair. My father never revealed his estranged wife to her. After I was born, he never revealed my existence to his family. Could it have been because my mother was a white woman? My father, a Jamaican immigrant, would be admonished for dating outside his race. Or was it because he was worried about being deemed an adulterer, an even worse stigma as he came from a religious background? Whatever the case, I didn't know I was a secret until my 13th birthday. Walking into my aunt's apartment brought a surge of emotions. What if my family didn't want anything to do with me because I was half white? How quickly can I learn the inside jokes that my family members held? Should I hold them accountable for all the years they missed out on? My mind whirled as I was introduced to everyone, trying desperately to feel something for my family members who were basically strangers. My family, if I was even allowed to call them that, fell right into their routine of catching up. Leah, did you pick a college yet? How come Brian hasn't come to church? Auntie Zoe, when are you going to braid my hair again? Meanwhile, I was struggling just to learn everybody's names. Oddly, my father stood off to the side, silently. Even odder was that nobody encouraged him to join us. Soon, I understood. The wave of awkwardness finally began to present itself, as we were no longer trying to hide the discomfort in ourselves. One of my aunts, who'd been quiet for most of the morning, looked at me with tearful eyes. She mentioned how happy she was for my father to have a daughter, saying, "He's always dreamt of walking a daughter down the aisle." However, she then expressed her anger towards my father for keeping the family in the dark about me when I needed not only nurturing but an introduction into the Jamaican culture. She ended with an apology for not even knowing I existed. If it wasn't already hard for me to process everything going on, it had just gotten much more complicated. My heart seemed to fly around inside me and settled itself in my throat, a good thing, so I couldn't let out a sob. I began to tear up, yet I wasn't alone. Tears were falling all around, and to this day, I'm not sure if they felt sorry for me, or for themselves, or for all of us. For a long time, I hated existing as a stereotype of a black child without a father. I hated looking at my mother, knowing this life of being a struggling single mother with a child was not the life that she had dreamt of. I hated feeling like a mistake. I hated not knowing what it meant to be Jamaican, or biracial, for that matter. I hated not knowing myself, yet being labeled regardless. From this experience, I oddly admire my father. It doesn't make up for all of that I've missed out on, the empty promises, but he had owned up to his mistakes in search of forgiveness. I had learned from this experience more about what it means to be biracial. Can I still consider myself Jamaican, even though my first time trying curry goat, a traditional dish, was not until my teenage years? Even though I grew up unaware of holidays, practices, all the things that made up the culture, I've become aware that no matter how much DNA you might share with a particular ethnicity, you won't feel truly connected if you didn't grow up with that culture's customs. In spite of this, I still find it amazing that whenever people ask me about my race, the first one I say is Jamaican. Is it to shock them, since I have such white features? Or because I yearn to feel like a true Jamaican? I'm still figuring it out. I believe this event has shaped me into becoming a more understanding person when analyzing someone else's actions. When confronted with making a judgment on somebody, like I did my father, I ask myself what I would have done. I have realized that I am more than a stereotype and far from a mistake. I'm determined to prove that I'm here for a reason by utilizing my talents to benefit those around me. I have grown in not relying on my parents and families to tell me who I am, but I have comprehended and exercised my integrity to find myself. The next article is titled 10 Activities to Do on a Low Confidence Day by Sophie Avedisian, and this is published in The Teen Mag. We all have days where negative thoughts about ourselves inundate our minds. These intrusive thoughts instantly put us in a bad mood, which seems impossible to avoid. Experiencing low self-esteem days is completely normal. Remember, you are not your thoughts. But these 10 activities will assist you in grappling with a bad confidence day. Number 1. Acknowledge your feelings. Although it may be natural, trying to ignore your negative feelings by distracting yourself is not going to help subside your intrusive thoughts. As you've probably heard, half the battle is recognizing how you're feeling, as this is key to overcoming these feelings. You most likely will find that acknowledging the fact that you're having a low self-esteem day is difficult, more than you might think. But once you push yourself to do so, you can work to surpass these negative feelings. Number 2, exercise. It is understandable to not feel motivated on a bad confidence day, but to deal with a low confidence day, you have to challenge yourself to do things that may feel burdensome or uncomfortable. Take a quick walk around your neighborhood, or even doing a 10-minute workout will put you in a better mood. Exercising does not need to be strenuous. Even doing yoga or stretching will allow you to move your body in a low impact form. Number 3, tomorrow is a new day. Make sure to remind yourself that tomorrow will be a new day, a fresh start. The negative feelings you've experiencing are temporary and will disappear soon. Sometimes having a low self-esteem day will push you to be more positive and kind to yourself the following day. Also, a bad confidence day makes you stronger, and it is important to be able to overcome negative thoughts and emotions. Number 4, give yourself a break. A bad confidence day is a day where you need to take time for yourself. Do the things you love, even if it means ignoring your to-do list for the day. Remind yourself that you deserve time to unwind and relax. You are human, and you should let yourself feel. Putting on a fake smile or a mask is a temporary change. If you don't allow yourself to truly feel your emotions, the same feelings will come back. So, urge yourself to feel, and then you can finally move on. Number 5, ignore social media. Scrolling on social media for hours on end will most likely end up making you feel worse about yourself. When trying to get through a bad confidence day, disengaging from activities that will aggravate your negative feelings is key. So, if you know that social media affects your mental well-being, avoid them for one day, then that might serve your best interest. But if this is an unrealistic goal for you, challenge yourself to only take a look at accounts that bring you up, not down. Number 6, take a soothing shower or bath. Take a nice hot bath or shower. That can be one of my favorite forms of self-care. Turn on some music, take a few deep breaths, and enjoy some time by yourself. You can even read a book or a magazine, depending on what sounds the most enjoyable to you. I love to put on a podcast whenever I'm taking a long bath. Whatever you choose to do, relax when taking a bath. Push yourself to stay in the present. Number 7, think about aspects of your life that make you happy. When you catch yourself being unnecessarily hard on yourself, think about parts of your day that bring you joy. Have you had any recent successes that you're proud of? Did you catch up with your friends a few days ago? Remind yourself that you are not worthless by reflecting on aspects of your life that bring you happiness. Number 8, surround yourself with positive people. Spending time with people who bring you joy is a great way to overcome low self-esteem. But depending on your personality, spending a bad confidence day alone might be a better choice. Take a moment to understand what you feel like doing, whether that includes being with friends and then those closest to you, or being alone for the day. Number 9, treat yourself like you would treat a friend. Though this is a common saying, it is always important to remind yourself of this when you find yourself having a low confidence day. If your friend felt unconfident, what would that say to them? What would you say to them? Most likely, you would remind them of the qualities you appreciate in them to make them feel worthy. So I urge you to do the same for yourself. Don't tear yourself down when you need to treat yourself with kindness the most. Number 10, remind yourself that no one is perfect. All of our negative self-talk is different. For some, bad body image is a struggle. For others, feeling that they are not doing enough in their lives can be the challenge that they are trying to overcome. Whatever your battle is, it is essential to remind yourself that no one is perfect. The person you are comparing yourself to is comparing themselves to someone else. Perfect does not exist, and therefore, you will always fail to achieve society's standards. Low self-esteem days are inevitable. Rather than trying to avoid them, work to handle them well. Prioritize taking care of yourself and remind yourself of your worth. These 10 activities are here to help you with getting through a bad confidence day. This was written by Sophine Avedisian. Sophine Avedisian is a freshman at Westridge School for Girls. She is the author of Stand Tall, a book that highlights women's rights issues. She's an editor for Polyphony Lit and a Los Angeles Times High School Insider. During her free time, Sophine enjoys reading, playing soccer, and spending time with family and friends. Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.